when they told me originally, are you going to get in the television business? I said, yeah, I can't wait. They said, well, it's not going to last long. You know, it doesn't happen because that's just a very fickle business. Turned out not to be so. There are pros, there are amateurs, and then there's another category that's in between the two. And we said, this is silly. Let's just form an ATP and let's move this game forward. And frankly, that's what happened.
Why did you have a tear in your eye when Roger Federer won that first Wimbledon?
Because it was an iconic moment. It was one of those things that, you know, you knew this was the beginning of something big and special. If you can play and think of every moment as you've got to play this like it's the last thing that you will ever do, and that's the most important thing you will ever do. It's a tremendous lesson that everybody can learn, not just tennis players, but for people in every walk of life.
All right, welcome everyone to another version of the Tennis Worthy podcast brought to you by our friends at the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I am your host, Patrick McEnroe, also known as the president at the moment of the Tennis Hall of Fame, I am extremely honored to be. I'm here in our museum, which is undergoing some renovations. It's going to be brand spanking new in May of 2025, and we're looking forward to that reopening. A man who resides here in the International Tennis Hall of Fame is my good buddy. I call him a combination of my father figure, my brother figure, my mentor, and most importantly, my good friend, my great friend, the one and only Mr. Cliff Drysdale. Welcome to Tennis Worthy, Cliff.
Very nice invitation, and I appreciate it. And I know under your leadership, there are going to continue to be improvements at the International Tennis Hall of Fame, and I am truly proud to A, call you my friend, and B, be a part of the International Tennis Hall of Fame.
2013, I believe, was a year that you were inducted into the Hall of Fame as a contributor. Of course, you were known as a tremendous player in your day. Back up, you got as high as number 4 in the world, U.S. Open finalist, beat the Rocket Rod Laver in the first ever Open U.S. Open, correct, Cliff?
Yes, you did your homework, yes. And I did. I beat the great Rocket, and he won the Grand Slam the next year, all 4 majors. And I feel like I won that tournament for Arthur Ashe because I had a very spotty record against Arthur. I was a bit fuddled by his game, and he took me down in the next round relatively easily.
By the way, this is the great Arthur Ashe right behind me here, statue of Arthur. Of course, it's Black History Month, so I've done another podcast commemorating his 75 Wimbledon epic win in the final over Jimmy Connors. As you said, he won his first major in New York that first year. It was open at the U.S. Open over Tom Ocker in the championship match. But it was a few years before he was finally able to win Wimbledon. So before we get into the history of the ATP, which I want to get into with you, just some thoughts from you, Cliff, on Arthur as the player before we get into the other side of Arthur, which, of course, is maybe magnified even more so what he did off the court.
He was a very annoying player for me to play against because he basically had one speed, and that was full speed ahead. So he controlled the points, he controlled the match. You never, basically, I was never anyway, because I didn't have the power game. And so I was sort of at his mercy. I was able to take him down a couple of times, but for the most part, Patrick, I found his game to be very difficult to play against because he was as the Australians would say, Sydney of the Bush, he had great power game. Look, it's not like he didn't have finesse. He had some, but for the most part, he knew that what was going to win matches for him was his power. He was, I know that you like this when I say he was a flat ball hitter. He did not have a lot of spin on his shots. He went for it. And I had a terrible time. It's not about me, but I'm just pointing out to you that for those who played against Arthur, for the most part, we were his opponents on our heels.
You know, the other podcast I've done recently for the Hall of Fame, Cliff, was about that win that Arthur had in the Wimbledon final with your buddy Charlie Passerell, who I know you guys are still close. You guys were part of that formation of the ATP, which we're going to get into, and the great historian Richard Evans. But it's interesting because I actually went back and watched that Wimbledon final when Arthur beat Connors. And both the guys talked about it, how he completely changed his style for that match against Connors. He slow-balled him. When Jimbo came to the net, he played the little short ball. He lobbed consistently, especially in those first couple of sets. So he sort of went off of his normal game because that type of game actually played into the hands of a young Jimmy Connors who fed off the pace.
Correct. He had never beaten him before. And so it was a huge shock that A, he was able to win those first two sets as easily as he did. And the answer is yes, he definitely played a different game and it worked very well. I've been on the losing side of those kinds of changes of tactics. And Jimmy Connors was on the losing side of that effort by Arthur, except that the occasion was of such huge significance for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, no question about that. Cliff Drysdale joining me here on Tennis Worthy, my longtime partner at ESPN. In fact, Cliff's been on ESPN since ESPN started covering tennis in 1979. So I've been with ESPN now for almost 30 years. And as I said, Cliff, you were my mentor in many ways when I got started. And you are known throughout the world as the voice of tennis, especially on ESPN. How does that sound to you?
Oh, Patrick, it sounds good. It's been a labor of love, you know, and I've said a lot of words on ESPN, a lot of them with you, a lot of them with a great variety of different people that have become my friends, you especially. But I mean, guys like Dickie Enberg, God rest his soul, he was a wonderful human being that brings a smile to your face and to mine. It started out, you know, with some of the great voices. Pat Summerall was the very first announcer that I did anything with, and he was an iconic voice as well. And it's been a terrific ride that it has lasted, as you pointed out, since 1979. That makes it about 45 years, if my arithmetic is correct. And when they told me originally, are you going to get in the television business? I said, yeah, I can't wait. They said, well, it's not going to last long. You know, it doesn't happen because that's just a very fickle business. Turned out not to be so.
Yeah, well, that's because you're the man. We call you the Lord. Lord Drysdale is what we call him at ESPN. He's our father figure. And we love you and we love what you've done for ESPN. I want to talk about what you did for tennis, okay, specifically the ATP and the ATP Tour, which didn't exist before guys like you came along, you and Charlie Passerell, and others. So take us back. I heard an interview you did where you talked about you were in the bowels of Forest Hill Stadium, you know, having meetings with other players. And educate us and the listeners about how it all started, because now we see, you know, these massive tournaments all over the world. And I know you always looked with pride on those tournaments outside them, you know, for the majors, of course, but the other events as well. So take us back to how that all started for Cliff Drysdale.
Well, let me try to put it in context because it's a really complicated story, Patrick, as you know. The early days of professional tennis, I suppose, went all the way back to Bill Tindon, Suzanne Long, Pancho Gonzalez, players of that ilk, when the majority of tennis, almost all of it, was played on an amateur basis, so that the only money that anybody ever got who played in those eras, and I was in both eras, was what you could get under the table for your supposedly expenses. But nobody who was in the amateur game made a lot of money. And so there were certain players who were picked off from the amateur ranks. For example, in 1962, Laver wins the Grand Slam, right? And then when that is over, the little professional tour that had Gonzalez and Hode as part of that group that I used to follow when I was a kid. I was fascinated by the 100-match series that they played against each other. But then they signed Laver, then they signed Rosewall, and it became difficult to rationalize how you could keep the amateur game afloat. But the International Tennis Federation and the Grand Slams were able to keep everything afloat for more years than I imagined, actually, because it wasn't then until 1968 when Lamar Hunt signed 8 players, euphemistically called a handsome 8.
Of which you were one.
Of which I was one. And that really took a huge bite out of the amateur game. And it became clear to Wimbledon, who were really the forerunners of the modern professional game, that if they were going to continue to be the biggest event in tennis, they were going to have to consider a change. And it was a huge change. They had a little exhibition match on center court, and Herman David said, if this is a success, then we're going to open Wimbledon, which they did the following year. So 1969, Wimbledon is open, and tennis is open, tennis booms, and that's basically all she wrote. There's so much more to the story because the formation of the ATP then follows. WCT has one section of the calendar. The International Tennis Federation and Jack Cramer and the men's pro tour have another portion of the year. And the players are sort of sitting out there in the middle saying, what about us? And we have a meeting, as you pointed out, in the bowels of Forest Hills. That was in 1972 during the US Open. And we basically said, listen, it's too long a story to go into the details, but there are pros, there are amateurs, and then there's another category that's in between the two. And we said, this is silly. Let's just form an ATP and let's move this game forward. And frankly, that's what happened. It was the following year that we made the huge decision to boycott Wimbledon for a reason that is, I don't know if you want us to go into that one, Patrick.
Yeah, sure. Nicky Pilic got, they wouldn't let him play because he didn't play for his country.
So the International Tennis Federation made this power play against the players, as I saw it anyway, and they trying to maintain control. And when we sat down at Wimbledon and had a big player meeting there the following year, that was another huge decision. The first one was to form the ATP. The second one was to make this big decision to walk out on Wimbledon, which we did that year. And God bless Stan Smith, who had won it the previous year, was part of 81 players who said, we're toast, we're not going to play Wimbledon this year. Changed the whole category, the whole nature of the game, because the world and the amateur associations, ITF, realized, and including the majors, by the way, that the players were here to stay. They wanted a say in the future of the game, and they got it.
What was it like to be the president of the ATP when it first started and still be a highly competitive ranked player? Like, how did you balance those two entities?
You know, the players, I suppose, these days spend a lot more time working out and honing their games and stuff than we did in my era, Patrick, but I never found it onerous thing at all. Plus, I was sort of trudging toward the end of my career, so I never felt like I was making a huge sacrifice on court for the fact of trying to inspire the ATP to keep moving forward. By the way, Arthur Ashe, you mentioned him earlier. He was the guy that took over from me after 2 years as president, and those were really critical years when the players needed a leader like Arthur to look up to and to say, okay, we're headed in the right direction. The tour for a while was run by what was called the Men's International Professional Tennis Council. It was 3 tournament directors, it was 3 ITF people, and it was 3 ATP guys. And then eventually that big press conference in New York during the US Open, and the ATP announces, we're out of here, we're going to form our own ATP or our own kind of PGA equivalent of tennis, and that changed things again.
Well, looking back on that, do you think that was a good move?
Yes, I do. I think it was a natural move, a normal move, and I think that we started stumbling through those years of the MIPTC where we had all these different groups that had an interest in the promotion of tennis, and it was probably not the most professional way to go, and the players were always complaining that the ITF had too much of a say, and the ITF were thinking that the players did, and then the tournament directors were sort of in the middle of it, trying to provide some balance. But it was a big elephant to run the game with, and I think it was a good thing that the ATP took the reins of the professional tour, which they did.
And when you see the way that the tour has grown, right, the big events, the Master Series events, of course, Charlie Passerell was part of, he and Ray Moore, another South African, of course, with the impetus behind that great event in the desert and others in Europe, especially and around the globe. Did you ever envision seeing those types of events outside the, I mean, the majors just seem to get bigger and bigger every year, but also those Masters events and what that's done for the tour. Do you think that's been overall a net positive for the sport?
Tremendous positive. And I give Charlie Passerell, who you already talked to, great credit for it, because he had this vision of fewer tournaments and bigger tournaments. And it has come full circle now, because you've got all these two-week tournaments now, like what Cincinnati will be, and like the Canadian Open will be, two full weeks, if there's just like the majors, and Indian Wells, of course. So, yeah, I think that things have... I'm very proud of what the ATP has become, Patrick. I don't think there's any argument with that. Tennis still has all of these balls in the air. There's the association that Novak Djokovic was very much a part of starting, that are also trying to find their way, and whether they should be more of a true players union rather than an association that has part ownership of not only the tournaments but the television rights in a lot of cases. But those are not the growing pains that we had in the years during the formation of the ATP. These latest things, to me, are more just like slight manipulations to make things better.
When Arthur Ashe took over as the president, and you had served for a couple of years, were you involved with him personally quite a bit in that process, and that process of handing over the reins to Arthur?
I always loved Arthur, Patrick. We had some differences in our politics. I felt that in certain ways that the group of guys that he was a part of had some conflicts. So we had sort of an enjoyable relationship, but we were not what I would consider to be great friends. That said, when we started to do television together, ABC some, for the most part, a few years later, we become very fast friends. We're golfers. He used to take me down on the golf course as easily as he did on the tennis court. And I learned to love him as a human being. And as I look back on him now and read some of the things that he wrote and considered the great contribution that he made socially and in so many other dramatic ways, I'm proud. I'm really proud to say that Arthur and I were great friends.
It was interesting talking to Charlie Passerell specifically about his friendship with Arthur. Of course, they were very tight. They went to UCLA together. And I asked him about, and I'll ask you the same, about, you know, the challenges Arthur obviously had to face as a black man growing up in a white sport, coming from Virginia, and then also kind of being thrust into this position, you know, where he could help change society. And Charlie said something really interesting. He said, you know, I just thought of Arthur as my buddy. I never really thought about that and sort of the pressure that he was under as a player, but most importantly, as a person with all this responsibility on his shoulders. Did you ever feel that being around Arthur as much as you were when he was in those years of leadership?
It's a very interesting comment because he's sort of an iconic figure. You know, you look back on Arthur now and you read about him and his history, and you say this was somebody really special. But what Charlie was saying was he was one of the guys. I mean, we went out and we had fun together. We would drink beers together and play golf and do do things that it was hard to look at him and think to yourself, this man is making history, which he was, but it was hard because we were just doing the normal things that we did. So I can fully understand what Charlie was saying. That said, there was a gentle nature about Arthur, a wonderful, warm, his dad said to him, look, you're a black man in this white man's world, and one of the things that you should try to accomplish at least is take the losses, it's like you take the wins, and not make it too dramatic. In today's world, that might not fly, but in that day, in those times, and in those days, Patrick, in my opinion, it was exactly the right thing to do because he did have an emotional connection with blacks, with whites. Listen, he was incredibly popular. He was a black man in a white man's sport, incredibly popular. Everybody always wanted him to win. None more so than that final at Wimbledon that you talked about. I mean, everybody wanted him to win for a variety of reasons, but mostly just because he was this black athlete that was going to become iconic.
The Hall of Famer Cliff Drysdale joining me here on the Tennis Worthy podcast. And when you look at the landscape today now, Cliff, of professional tennis, and you hear about, you know, in the last couple of years, we've heard about, well, the Saudis are going to come in and they're going to do something similar to what they did with LIV and with golf. And there's much more money out there potentially for the players. And to your earlier point about a player union, is that where a player union could be helpful in that process? Or how do you gauge where, you know, the player input and how much, you know, influence they should have moving forward with the way the calendar looks and where tennis is played on a global scale?
Yeah, that's a really good question and a tough one, Patrick, because there are really two answers to that. The one question is, should the players be an association, which is basically what they are now, owning tournaments and owning television rights, etc., or should they be a straight union where they just say, listen, you can afford to pay us more money, we're in here for the money, we want to be a union? And I think that the answer to that question is to me still up in the air. I'm not sure that you can have a combination of those two things that can work, but it seems to have worked pretty well so far through all of these years of the ATP. So I would not be in favor of another major overhaul of the way the tennis is now, because I think the tennis is on a pretty good path. That we would not have a little tweaking to where the players might have more of a say and get aggravated about some of the things that the players believe and I agree with, where they are not getting quite as much of the pie as they should be getting. I'd like to see that happen too, but I'd like to see it happen gently.
Let's tap dance around a few sort of more modern topics, Cliff, as we touch on the history of the ATP and where that has gone. And I'd be interested just to hear, we missed you down in Australia at the Australian Open. Of course, you'll be back with the ESPN team at Wimbledon in the US Open. What was your take on what you saw from Australia on Sinner, on the great Novak Djokovic? Does he have one more left in him? And of course, I want to hear your thoughts on the great win for Madison Keys as well.
Djokovic has got another one in him, yes. I'm prepared to put a dinner at Le Bouchon with okay. you on that subject. If you disagree, if you don't, then that should just lie on the table. There's no as for Sinner, I think he's the best player in the world right now, Patrick. And if I were to bet, I would say that he could probably be it could be the greatest of all time. I mean, that's a little too early to speak in those terms now. Because, of course, you've got Carlos Alcaraz, who's right there alongside him. And that is a story that has not been as fully told yet, clearly. And it's going to be what I think the great story of the next few years of men's tennis. As for the great win in the women's singles, Patrick, I thought that That was something that we have been waiting for from Madison Keys for so long. And in a way, it brings a big smile to my face because there are those among us who really wrote her off, you know, and said, listen, Madison is a great player. She's a great talent. She's strong. She hits the ball with all the power that you need. But she's never actually going to win a major. So that she did was, I think, I hope it's a precursor for her being a part of the conversation when we come to who's going to win at Wimbledon and the US Open. I hope it really is a part of that conversation, and I think it can be.
Yeah, I don't think there are many people in the tennis community, and I include current players, that were not smiling ear to ear when they saw Madison Keys win that Australian Open title. Boy, it was so impressive the way she did it. I mean, Rybakina she beat, Svitolina, I believe she beat, in a course, in the two semifinals and final to beat the top two players, Swiatek, when she had to save a match point, and then Sabalenka in another long, great three-setter, and do it in different ways. So it was, like you said, it was cool to watch. It was a great moment for her, and I think for tennis overall, to see her finally get over the hump. Someone that's one of the good, real good people in tennis, to see her hold that major trophy was pretty darn cool.
You think she's going to win another one, Patrick?
I think she could win. She was on her way to.
What good will she?
I think she will. I think she'll win Wimbledon. I think this year is a good chance. She was on her way to having a good chance to win it last year. I remember when she got injured late in the match. I think it was in the round of 16 or quarters. And, of course, we know how that, turned. I mean, Krejcikova, an excellent player, but certainly Madison would have had an excellent chance, I believe. So I think she can. I think now that, the pressure's off, I think she'll play well. Let me ask you also about the American men, because there's quite a few of them doing well, very well. Obviously, Taylor Fritz is right there in the top five. You've now got Tommy Paul for the first time in the top 10. Ben Shelton knocking on the door. Of course, there's Korda. There's Tiafoe. There's some good younger ones that came up and made some a splash or two at the Australian Open. Lerner Tien and Alex Mickelson are two that I think of. What's your overall take on the American men, and can any of them win a major?
The answer to that is definitely yes. Patrick, I just feel like we need somebody to really take the, take the bull by the horns and make the statement. The problem is, as I look from above, when you look at the way that men's tennis has developed over the last couple of decades, we've had the Fabulous Four, if you want to include Andy Murray in that, and it looked for all the world like when that era was over, and it's closing in on being over now, clearly, that there would be all kinds of opportunity for the players that you mentioned from the US, among other countries, of course. But then you have this Yannick Sinner who comes up, and the Spaniard, and they kind of are dominating this part of the year, and then you've got that whole group of people caught between them. So can one of them make a move and be a standout and win a major? Yes, of course. But it's a problem for them because they're sort of caught in this era in between the greats of the Fabulous Four and now this Sinner Alcaraz era.
Two of my great memories of working with ESPN. One was calling the epic Nadal Federer final, when Rafa won his first Wimbledon, with our buddy Dick Enberg, because we were calling it for, remember, we weren't live on ESPN in those years. We were calling in case it became a classic. So, of course, I would always say at the beginning of the telecast, this is definitely going to be a classic. Because you knew that if it wasn't a classic, it would never make air. So I was like a genius. But I sat there with Dick Enberg up in the roof of center court when that happened. It was one of my great moments in broadcasting. One of my other great moments was calling with you the first time that Roger Federer won Wimbledon in 2003, I believe it was, against Mark Philippoussis, the big serving Aussie. And do you remember, Cliff, that you had a tear in your eye when Roger Federer one got down on his knees and then he got up and then he, you know, got the trophy. Why did you have a tear in your eye when Roger Federer won that first Wimbledon?
Because it was an iconic moment. It was one of those things that, you know, you knew this was the beginning of something big and special. And to be a part of it, be alongside you for that moment was nice, Patrick. That Ash Connors in 75 was one of those moments when you sort of, you knew this was going to be the start of something big. And of course it wasn't. So was that moment. And if I impressed you that much with a tear or two, I'm going to try here in the next couple of tournaments that we work together to see if I can drum up another tear or two.
Okay. Let's look back on the big four, specifically the big three. Of course, Andy Murray and there, Stan Wawrinka, both those guys will, I'm sure, end up here in the International Tennis Hall of Fame. Novak is still going. Rafa was, Rafa and what he did on, especially on clay, amazing. What stands out as you look back on those three or those four, however you want to term it, over the course of your career? What memories do you have that they're etched in your brain?
The artistic ballet-like movement of Roger Federer, his incredible ability to figure out where the next ball was going to be according to who he was going to play against. So his incomparable anticipationary skills, if that's a word. For Rafa, it was his guts and determination and his will to play every point, which Roger didn't do. Played every point like it was the final of Wimbledon point, match point. And it's a tremendous lesson that everybody can learn, not just tennis players, but for people in every walk of life. If you can play and think of every moment as you've got to play this like it's the last thing that you will ever do, and that's the most important thing you will ever do, then do that. As for Novak, what impressed me most about him was as a kid when he said, I want to be the number one player in the world. And he's not that much younger than the other two. And that he would say something like that in this world, which was dominated completely by Federer and Nadal, and mean that he thinks that he's going to be able to compete with those guys and become the number one in the world. And the effort and the energy that he put into him proving himself as a tennis player and as a person over the years, do not think he gets enough credit for that. It's hard work, it's talent, obviously that he has, and it is incredible self-belief. So I have tremendous admiration for all three of those guys, and I'm proud to have lived with you through those years of those three guys and what they accomplished.
Oh, yeah. It was special. And I was looking at some old clips, and I think it was after the U.S. Open. It was 11 or 12 when I think Novak won three of the majors, and Rafa said something to the effect of, you know, Novak, it's an unbelievable year. What you did was basically impossible, you know, to do it. And, you know, can never be done again. And then Novak was interviewed, asked about it. I don't know if it was after the match or it was shortly after, and they referenced the comments from Rafa. And Novak said something very telling. He paused for a second and he said, you know, nothing's impossible. And he's sort of done that, hasn't he? I mean, it's amazing how he was in his 30s. He just sprinted past both those guys with his level of excellence and commitment on every surface. To me, that's what makes him the greatest of all time, is that he was so good on every surface, under every type of condition, against the two of the greatest ever, that he beat them in their prime, both on their favorite surfaces.
I put a full exclamation mark of agreement with that, Patrick. I totally get that. The other thing that that I kind of really like about him is that he is so articulate. And if you listen to him over the years and listen to his pronouncements and his press conferences, there is no way that he can be saying the things that he says and be, like some people say, inauthentic. I just don't buy it. I think he's an authentic genius on the tennis court, and off the court, I think genius may be a little too strong a word, but that he is one very smart guy who has spent so much of his time improving himself, as I said earlier, as a human being and as a tennis player. I'm a big fan of his, and I don't think is inauthentic, and I don't think the things that he's saying for a reason other than this is what he believes, truly.
I'll take you up on that bet, by the way. I don't think he's going to win another major, meaning Djokovic. He's won 24. Of course, he may, and I'll be very happy to take you to dinner, whether he does or he doesn't. But I'll just take, you know, a fun bet. I actually said at the beginning of last year, when someone asked me, I said I didn't think he was going to win another major. Now, the Olympics, of course, was huge. He won that last year, but he didn't win a major. Of course, he can. Of course, I wouldn't be shocked if he does. But when I look at those other two guys, and I look at even a couple other guys sort of floating around, but specifically those two, it's hard for me to imagine him beating one of those two guys in best of five when it comes down to it. What else, Cliff Drysdale, are you looking forward to in 2025 in professional tennis?
I think this has been a wide-ranging conversation, and it has just juiced me up to look forward to see how all of these things turn out. And the fact that I wish there was a way that you could apologize profusely when Novak does host another trophy. I don't know exactly
how. I will. I'll do that. No, I'll do it. Yeah.
I don't know. How, so like BG would say, I'm going to do 100 push-ups or something like that, you know, when that happens.
I don't know if I can do that many, but I'll do a few. But I'll take you to a nice dinner, and we've had our share over the years. I miss you on the road when you're not there. So thank you for joining me here on the Tennis Worthy Podcast. Come visit us here in Newport anytime, a Hall of Famer. You are always welcome. We're looking forward to this year welcoming Maria Sharapova and, of course, Bob and Mike Bryan coming into the Hall of Fame this year. So we're looking forward to that. And next year, there may be a guy by the name of Roger coming in 2026. So we'll be looking forward to that as well.
Congratulations to those people, Patrick, and thanks to you for the hard work that you put in at the Hall of Fame. It could not be led by anybody more exciting, interesting, and effective than you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cliff Drysdale, here on the Tennis Worthy Podcast.